Okay. Thank you. Thanks for the introduction. First of all, I'd like to thank the organizers of this seminar series. In fact, last year, I was invited to give a lecture. However, due to other commitments, I couldn't make it, so I'm happy that finally I could make it. And the topic that I would like to talk about today is of great interest for us, and I'll try to explain why. And interestingly, I think it's a topic that may be of interest to the mathematical sciences, to the optimization community, et cetera. And actually, this is a topic that was brought to us by our CEO. He was particularly interested in solving those problems, so I figure it would be a good way of bringing optimization into the mainstream at the company. So that's the challenge that we're facing. So the topic of my talk is on risk management in the industrial gas supply chain, right? So what are the risks involved in the industrial gas supply chain, and how do they affect us, ultimately in financially, how that impact our operations, right? And here, I'd like to point out that this work is co-developed with a colleague of mine, Atul Rangarajan, who's also working in the mathematical program. So the outline of my presentation, I'll first give you an introduction to the industrial gas business and Praxair. And the reason here is just to set the stage for the problems that we're trying to solve. So I'll mention first what we do in terms of production and distribution and operations, and also the industrial gas supply chain, right? After that, I'll talk about the risks involved in the industrial gas business and how do they impact our decisions. And finally, provided I have enough time, I'll talk about one of the problems in which we actually use optimization and some of the techniques that Nick just mentioned. In a way, we're trying to use global optimization to solve a non-convex MINLP in this case. And the problem in this particular case was capacity allocation and distribution planning and under demand risk. So we're just looking at one of the risk dimensions that are present there. So let me give you just an overview of the company. Praxair is an industrial gas company. We have $10.1 billion 2010 sales. There are basically four players in the world, four major players, Air Liquide, Air Products, Praxair, and Linde, two European, two North American companies. We have operations in several countries. And here, just to give you a flavor, is actually not necessarily a manufacturing market, but we're widely spread into different fields such as healthcare, manufacturing, food and beverage, et cetera, et cetera. So this pie here on the, actually this is a remote. Yeah, this pie here shows you, the different end markets for our business. The other interesting characteristic here, we are in several geographies. Still, North America is roughly half of the pie in terms of sales, but what we're seeing is a rapid growth in the blue and especially the red slice, right? So this is the growth business, and this will impact our risk analysis significantly, as I'll mention in a minute. I think here the other point to be made, it's seen by the market as a very well-run company. Here, just to give you an idea, this is the S&P 500 over the past 12 years. This is our biggest North American competitor. I won't mention the name. I mentioned already. And this is Praxair, right? So we got about 100%. Can't see it now. Significantly higher than the S&P 500. Focus areas, emerging markets, energy, and environmental applications. Okay, so getting into the supply chain. So what are our sources of revenue? So basically, there are three major categories of revenue. One is what we call on-site pipeline supply. So what will be the end markets for that? Will be steel mills, refineries, etc., in which we'll install a plant at the customer site, have long-term contracts, typically 15 years, and with a take-or-pay clause. So take-or-pay means if you consume it or not, you have to pay for that product. So it's a very, in terms of risk, it's a great contract because you're guaranteed at least a certain minimum amount of revenues in there. The other large chunk of our business is what we call merchant liquid supply. And you've probably seen this types of trucks. So basically here you have a liquid product that delivers to customers. We have 5 to 7 year contracts with the customer. And what we do here, we install a tank at a customer site. So the tank is owned by Praxair, and the inventory is managed by Praxair, or in this case, most industrial gas companies. And the third one is what we call the package business, which is basically cylinders for low demand customers. Universities, for instance, you know, have several of this gases, different of different types and sizes, and this is actually a byproduct from bulk. So the supply chain is actually here. You can see a type of that. So we have the on-site plant, and as a byproduct of the on-site plant, we have the liquid product, and as a byproduct of the liquid, we actually have the cylinder product. So these are the three main sources of revenue for the company, right? So if you look at the supply chain, so what will be the supply chain? Well, in fact, in terms of raw material, we use, and here I'm talking about in the context of air separation, so think of nitrogen, oxygen, and argon, right? So the supply chain is actually, our main product is free, so air. In fact, our biggest cost is energy, right? So it's a cryogenic separation, so we freeze, we increase the pressure, reduce the temperature, and that's how separation occurs. And actually, in the next stage, there's liquefaction to supply this market. So compressors are a big source of energy costs in that, so a big consumer of energy. Right? So here, this is the supply chain. So we have the on-site plant, so this is installed in a steel mill or in a refinery or in a large customer. This is supplied to a customer, if it could be a dedicated plant to that customer or it could be a pipeline. We have pipelines in Texas, we have pipelines in Chicago, where several customers and several of these plants are connected and serve those customers. Right? And in this case, here, as I mentioned, as a byproduct, we liquefy some of the products made here. We distribute to customers. And here you see the different types of customers. Here's just a small list. And here the small markets, you know, universities, small clinics, etc. Right? So this is our supply chain. Okay, moving on to the risks involved in this industrial gas business. And why are they important to us? So to mention the risk here, it's important to set the stage for what is the business model that at least that we have. Some other companies don't have this business model. But in this particular case, it's important because risk is it's even more significant in this case. So an air separation unit is typically a $5 million to $10 million dollar investment. It's a complex technology, especially engineering and construction. It's a highly integrated process. You know, energy is a big factor for us, so it has to be very well integrated. And the economics may depend on which markets we sell to. Right? So there are basically two types of business models. Some companies operate with what they call the sale of equipment. So what is exactly the idea? So you build a plant, you give to the customer, and then the customer will buy that plant operate, run it, etc. The other model is what we call the sale of gas. So, which is essentially we construct the plant, but we own the plant. And what we do in this case, we operate the plant and run the plant, and we ensure that the customer will receive what he needs and what he wants. So in this case, the industrial gas company will build, own, and operate the plant. And as I mentioned, we have a long-term contract. So typically a 15-year contract, right? And what happens here in this case, if we operate under this sale of gas, the risks that you have to consider are over the life of the project. I don't know if that's clear. Here in this case, once you construct the plant, say it takes 1 or 2 years to build the plant, you sell to the customer, you know, he has the burden of operating it and running it. In our case, because we're selling the gas, we have to make sure the gas is sold and the plant is well run over the lifetime of that project. Okay? So there are additional risks here that are involved as opposed to the sale of equipment model. Okay? As I mentioned here, the market forces, at least these are the three main areas in which we operate, and risks here, actually because of these areas, there are specific risks that we have to face. One is what we call emerging economies. Right? So emerging economies, you see a lot of the basic industry moving into particularly Asia. For instance, steel mills, I guess Canada is one example, US is the other, where a lot of the steel mills are moving to China, right? So we have this rapid expansion, a lot of infrastructure, industry, metals, steel, etc. And we have to move with them to those markets. Actually, industrial gas supply chains aren't global supply chains in the sense that I cannot produce gas here and sell in China. It's too expensive to do it. Right? Distribution plays a big role there. So we have to move with the company. Right? The other one is environmental applications. So a lot of new environmental applications, stricter regulations, and here energy becomes also very important. Right? So we have huge demand for hydrogen in refineries mostly, environmental concerns, gasification, so gas becomes an important, gasification becomes an important product process here, oxy-coal, which is combustion with oxygen, gas to liquid, coal to liquid, so here building the hydrocarbon supply chain from coal, for instance. Right? So with all this in mind, there is, and we face this, an increased risk profile. So two elements that I mentioned to you. So we have this sale of gas model, right? So we build a plant, we operate this plant, and we have this long-term contract, right? At the same time, we are going into economies for which we are not very familiar with, right? For instance, new geographies. In fact, it was maybe a month ago, Praxair announced a plant in Bahrain. So you can imagine, you know, new geographies, it's a big risk. So you don't know what's going to happen in 15 years. Right? So that's the lifetime of a project. So we're looking at opportunities in Egypt. We're getting into Russia. So geographies which we're not very familiar with. Right? We have also larger plants. So we're building plants that are larger and larger. I mentioned $100 million as capital. We just announced a plant of $1 billion in Brazil. So, you know, an order of magnitude higher. So increased risks involved, right? New technologies, supplier issues. So supplier issues are very important, as I'll mention. For instance, we have a lot of suppliers in different countries, usually low-cost sourcing. So we build pieces of equipment in Asia, and we bring them to a location, we assemble, so all risks involved in that, right? So the challenge, and actually that's what we were asked to look at, is how do we better understand and how we manage this risk? So we have all this risk, new risks that appear as a result of new opportunities that come. We had risks in the past, but these risks, I posed as a question here, but in fact they have increased significantly. We are investing more capital. We have here a portfolio of projects that is riskier than it used to be. The other thing that we were asked here is, can we quantify risk? So can we put a number on risks? Can we tell them how much is our return, but how much is our risk embedded in that? Right? And also, once we do this, can we adjust returns based on risk? So in other words, if we go to a riskier place, would you demand or would you have to imply higher returns or not? So those are the types of questions that we are asked to look at. Okay, so let me tell you, so based on this, I don't know if you have any questions, but again, we have, keep in mind that we build the plants, we invest the capital, we own the plant, and we operate that plant, right? So here we try to classify the risks involved in a project. So the first one here is what we call macro risk. So currency, inflation, country. And I'll get into more details of those, right? But those are macroeconomic risks. The other ones are execution risks. So once we win a project, we have to make sure the plant is built on time, on schedule, on budget. So there are issues on construction. Our supply base has to be performing well. The technology that we put in there has to be also sound. Right? Operations, I told you, it's a 15-year horizon, so we have to make sure that the plants are reliable, we have good maintenance policies, performance is important. Right? The other one is what we call the market risk. So we have the on-site demand, so we have the gas sold at the plant, but we also have the liquid market, and we have energy costs, which are going up, right? So we have to account for that as well. And the other interesting thing is those risks will emerge at different stages or at different phases of a project. So for instance, when we are looking at project opportunities, so we're trying to build a plant at a customer, there are risks involved, for instance, at the macro level. There are risks involved in the prediction of market demand. And we have to be, to present a project that is competitive and make us win this project. So on a 1-2 year project, that's typically when we negotiate with customers, it's a risk versus reward trade-off in this case. Once the project is won, we have what we call the project execution phase, and the risks involved in that are mostly around this part. So we have to make sure that engineering is performing, we have our suppliers. To give you an example, we are working with this plant in Russia, which is in Siberia, and we can only send the part of the cold box, one of the processing units that we have, we can only send that in the summer, late spring or early fall. Otherwise, you can't transport the product there. So there's supplier risks in here, right, on the execution. And then we have the plant operations. So we need to make sure that all this demand here really materializes. So we have actually the revenues coming not only from the on-site customer, but also from the market surrounding that customer. Okay, and here we have this capital commitment from stage one, and we're recovering this capital invested over a very long time span. So we're talking about 15 years, so we have to make sure that this capital is returned. Okay. So what are the challenges that we face? I mentioned some of them. So capital, is money a constraint? Actually, in our case, that's not a concern. Capital has never been a concern for us. We are always able to raise capital. The main constraint here for us is resources. Sometimes we don't have resources to do it. Strategic. So are there reasons to do a project even for lower returns? So sometimes you want to get into a geography in which we don't have any presence. So you have to accept lower returns. Or sometimes you have a very strong market share and you want to keep that position there. So you may accept lower returns. So there's strategic decisions in going to a market or building a plant. The portfolio, I mean, that we have several plants and we're investing heavily in some regions. Are we taking, too many risks involved in one region? For instance, we're investing a lot in China in gasification. What if, something happens in this market, in that region? So are we going to be very exposed on that or not? Right? So there's a risk involved in the portfolio. So as I mentioned here, we have engineering resources, we have labor resources available or not. Another example, we have this large plant in South America, and there are a lot of infrastructure projects going on now. So we have three refineries being built in Brazil. There's the World Cup, there's the Olympics, and the main concern that there's no engineering, there's no skilled labor to execute the project. So there's an engineering resource, or actually a labor resource in this case, unavailable or at a very high cost. Okay? Experience. Have we done similar projects or not? As I mentioned, we're building larger and larger plants. So scaling up is not trivial sometimes. Technology. We have technology evolving, plants becoming more efficient, and are we competitive, are we reliable under this new technology? Okay? There are several industry practice to manage decision, execution, and risk. Here, I won't get into the details, but there is this, on execution, there is this front-end loading process. A lot of the engineering EPC companies, they rely on this project. We have stage gate reviews, project management techniques that are used in this particular case. The investment decision features, usually we have, as I mentioned, long-term projects. We have complex and dynamic risks. And the metrics, how do we analyze projects? Like any capital investment decision, we look at NPV, we look at IRR, we look at EBITDA, we look at cash flow. Okay, so these are the metrics that we use to analyze a capital investment decision, right? So we have an opportunity in the plan. What is the return on the investment under this metric? And there are, sometimes they look at, IRR is one big one. So basically this is telling you how many years it takes you to have the return on your capital. As I mentioned here, we want now to quantify and evaluate risk. So what will be the pro of using a framework in which we can quantify risk? Well, first one, it will give you an objective number. It will give you a range, or it will give you a number to look at, right? Instead of just saying, I think it's going to be risky. Or I think this is riskier than that place. How much, right? So that's what we want to calculate or assess, right? If we can quantify risk, we can look at the return, so the return on this investment adjusted for risk. So for instance, you would accept to go to a riskier place if you have a higher return. That's how we usually invest, right? You go for a higher return with a higher risk, right? And then we can compare the impact of disparate risks on a project value and look at investment choices. So there are several risk factors in a project. How are they? How do they impact the decision? And in many cases, actually, that's a challenge. But the risks are correlated. Like, for instance, if we're talking about demand and price are correlated. So if demand goes down, usually price goes down with demand. So those risks, when we build a framework, we have to look at them on an integrated fashion. So what are the cons of that? What are the challenges? So sometimes risks cannot be quantified, or it's very hard to do it. And actually, there's I think the research areas have to address those. Research in risk management have to look at, especially in some risks, find better ways of quantifying that. The other thing, and that's what we heard from our CFO, he said the danger with quantifying risks is that you think you know more than you actually know, right? So when you give a number, a risk number, sometimes you're relying too much on that number, but actually you don't know much about that risk. And the other problem, and this is actually a big problem, and actually there are centers in business schools just looking at these types of risk. Wharton Business School, for instance, they try to look at this, what they call black swan events. So these are low probability, high impact risks. For instance, a hurricane or a terrorist attack. Things that could devastate a business or an investment, right? So they are very low probability, but they have a very high impact. So if you think about how we usually quantify risk, we assign, let's say you look at scenarios and you assign a probability to that scenario. So if this is a very low probability, sometimes it's hidden in all your different scenarios, so you don't look at that, right? So there may be better ways of doing this, black swan event. Okay, so let me give you an idea and how we are tackling this project. So here on this box is how we currently look at a capital decision, so a capital investment. So I'm just giving you the output of a capital investment. So a standard cash flow analysis will tell you, okay, you have to invest $40 million. It will take you 6 construction quarters to build a plant, so a year and a half. And this will give you an IRR of 16.2%, which is roughly 5-6 years that you have the return on investment, an NPV of $4.5 million. Okay? So that's how we look at, or how most companies look at, a capital investment. So you look at how much you're going to spend, how much time, and then you have all the other metrics, so you can look at cash flows, et cetera, right? So now, what if instead of looking at a project under this point or value, only one point value number here, you start thinking about this as a set of probabilities based on the risk that you have. So for instance, you can look at your capital, right? And you can look at what we define here as a cost ratio. So how much you actually spent over how much you thought you were going to spend. So for instance, this 40 million is before you start building it. So at the end, say you spent $38 million. So you have a cost ratio of 38 divided by 40. So you can look at all projects that we built, right? And we can actually segment those projects based on the type of plants you build, based on the customers you build. But you can actually build a probability distribution in which it will tell you, how close we were from that. So instead of looking at a $40 million, you can look at a probability distribution of a project. So a capital value here won't have a single point, but rather a distribution in there, right? The other thing you can look at, construction quarters. Have you faced delays in the past? And if so, how were they typically observed? And you can see here, people tend to think of probability distributions in a uniform way. This is clearly a case in which you don't have that, right? Usually you tend to be on the late side, not on the early side. You never finish before schedule. You always finish. If you finish differently from your prediction, you're always late, and sometimes by a lot. Right? And as I mentioned, for instance, if you start looking at risks on a probabilistic fashion, you have also to take into account that they are correlated. Right? So usually, for instance, if you look at delays and capital, they're usually positively correlated, right? Because the later it takes you to build a plant, you know, probably more cost you'll have incurred, right? And less revenue actually you have, right? So if you think of this in a higher dimension, you have actually lots of risks and lots of correlations among those risk factors. And here is we're trying actually to educate our decision makers on how we can look at risk from a probabilistic viewpoint rather than a point value. So instead of looking, let me go back here. Instead of looking at those two numbers, IRR and NPV, if we treat the inputs to our cash flow, so the risk factors that will impact your cash flow model from a probabilistic standpoint, and here I'm just showing two, but there are several others, what you end up having? Well, you have actually a distribution of your IRR. So in this particular case, for instance, it happened that there's a 50% probability that your IRR will be 16.2 or above. There is a 10% that will be 19.2% or above. But there is actually a 10% here probability that will be below 13%. So not only you're looking at a point, but you're looking at actually probabilities of returns based on the uncertainties that you have, right? And here you can see clearly the probability distribution. So the IRR could be, you know, from 8 to 25% with this. So here I just discretized those values in there. And similarly, you have an NPV distribution, and you have your cash flows. So the cash flows, actually what this is telling you is the range of cash flows that you will have based on the uncertainties that may incur in your project. Okay? So let me get into a little more detail in going back to our previous tree. I'm going to expand a little bit and have more detailed discussion on how can we quantify those different project risks. Okay, so if we go into macroeconomic risks, for instance, what is a country risk? So a country risk, there are several issues in there, right? For instance, political risk, right? So what is the investment safety in that? Is there a lot of corruption in there? Is there a chance of nationalization of your assets, right? So those are what we call country risks. Even if those risks don't occur, what about the legal risks in that country? So if you sign a contract, does that mean that this contract is enforced or not? Sometimes the legal system doesn't work as well as you think. You're used to, especially, you know, in our case, we're used to the U.S. legal system, but who knows if you're in a different country, you sign the contract may not mean anything there, or it may be very difficult to enforce, you know, clauses of that contract. What about regulatory risks, right? How easy is it to get a permit, or how easy it is to register a company in there? So there are all risks that sometimes we underestimate, and only when we start building the plant you see this happening, right? We're facing some of these risks in Russia, for instance. Yeah? Permitting is a big issue there. So here, there are some ways of looking at that. So there's one of the big sources of country risk is the Economist Intelligence Unit. There are some others. There's this Transparency International. There's this GCI, I'm sorry. That's the Global Competitiveness Index. So there are ways of quantifying risk, and we can look at those risks, so depending on the geographies we enter, and we can compare here, for instance, with the U.S. So this is the U.S. Here is a low-risk case. So Transparency, for instance, Transparency International, 100% is the best, right? So here's the U.S. If we take a sample country here, you know, it's not as transparent as the U.S. So you can try to quantify those risks based in that. So we have different rankings, and also you can look at credit rating agencies, so Fitch, Moody's, S&P, so you can look at bond ratings, etc. So all these are sources of country risk that we can incorporate into our decisions. The other piece of country risk, and this is actually a big challenge, if we were good at that, probably wouldn't be doing industrial gas. But it's to predict. Inflation is actually not that hard, but foreign exchange is a big one for us. So all our revenues are in dollars, right? So you get into new geographies, it's very difficult to predict and forecast foreign exchange rates. And here I'm talking about 15 years. I'm not talking about foreign exchange rates in the next 3 months. Right? So it's 15 year. If someone knows how to do that, you know, this person will be in high demand. Not by us, probably by other organizations. Right? So there are some ways of doing that. So here I'm just showing you some models they call, you know, you can do binomial or generalized Brownian motion. So you can look at historical data and you can try to do some forecasting. The risk here is that, you know, in many cases you have this disruptive movement. So what they call black swans. So for instance, a major devaluation, then your past data doesn't mean anything anymore. Right? So for instance, Brazil, we're trying to do some foreign exchange forecast. And if you look at data before 1999, it's probably worthless, right? Because, you know, there are several, you know, inflation was huge, several devaluations, so you cannot use historical data. So there are ways of doing that, and you can create this paths over a certain number of years, and then you can simulate and do this over a Monte Carlo framework and do those types of predictions. Right? But still, it's very difficult to do. And actually, you can try to do that not only for foreign exchange or inflation, but you can also try to do for energy costs as well, right? Which is a little easier than that because that's more on the commodity side. Right? So you can try to do that. The other blocks of risk that I mentioned are execution risks. So there is more of a qualitative way of assessing risk. So we can look at supplier, technology, regional risks, and quantify them as medium, low, or high. So you can assign that, and you can assign a number to that. So you can put a scale from 0 to 10, etc., and look at, you know, for instance, in a project, you have engineering risks. You have equipment risk, you have construction risk, and you can look into the different aspects of that. So supplier, you know, for instance, you can have a project in which you have a high risk in the equipment because it may be a large piece of equipment that the supplier never built, which we call first of a kind. So there are risks of not being performing at the level that you expect. And you can quantify this risk based on the different pieces of equipment, and we're doing that type of analysis. So you have several equipment units there, and you can give risks and look at the technology risk in that, and, you know, assign probabilities, etc. There's an interesting analysis of risk, and here just mentioned in green. This is actually done by NASA and DoD, especially for projects that they call first of a kind. So, you know, a new satellite system, an aircraft, they have frameworks, what they call this TRL-IRL. So it's technology readiness level. So they try to quantify that. Or integration readiness level. So sometimes the technology of a piece of equipment is known, but to integrate that to another piece of equipment, it's a challenge. So there's some ways of trying to quantify those risks in there. Okay. The other aspect that I mentioned, you know, operational risks. Are all the pieces of equipment able to provide function? Right? Availability. What is the uptime of a plant? Okay, so when a customer signs a contract, we have to guarantee that, you know, 95% of the time the plant has to be running at and providing that certain flow rate. Can we actually guarantee that? So there's some work that we're doing on reliability and availability analysis, in which we try to quantify that and incorporate those risks into our production. And typically, you see here the trade-off, right? So the more capital you invest, the less maintenance costs you have, but your total costs tend to be higher. Right? So the trade-off is there, and you know there's an optimal point, which is sometimes not very clear how to obtain. But you know, it's known that the more you invest on the CapEx, you will reduce your maintenance, right? But up to a certain point, you're not overinvest. So if you have one compressor, you can put a redundant compressor on the side, so your reliability will increase a lot, but you're spending a lot of money with the second compressor. Right? So there's a trade-off there. So we're looking at tools, and those are tools, this reliability block diagram analysis. This is based on Markov chains, and you can do probabilistic Monte Carlo analysis on that. You look at historical failure data, and you can try to predict reliability, availability, etc. So these are ways of quantifying operational risks. Okay? And last but not least, market risks. So we have risks, as I mentioned, we have the on-site demand, so the market, the customer base, so this is the plant, say, in this case, and the customer is sitting there. So that's the on-site customer. So usually we are pretty well covered on that. The only thing we have to look at is the financial strength or health of that customer. So we have to make sure that customer is financially healthy, that his end markets will perform well. For instance, it would be very risky to invest on a new steel mill in the U.S. because who knows if the market will be here. Right? So you have to look at, you know, financial health and the market served by that customer. But typically we are protected by this minimum take or pay clauses. So as long as the customer is healthy, financially healthy, he'll have to pay us at least a minimum amount, right? Even if the demand is not there. So these are risks in the on-site market. But here, the liquid market is actually a big one, because we say if a plant sits here, we have to sell on those trucks to a neighborhood around this customer. So how do we forecast demand in this area? So that's a big challenge. Sometimes if you have a specialized industry in this neighborhood, then it's relatively easy to do it. So if you have a bigger, an area where it's a car manufacturer, so you can predict more or less, you know, how much steel that industry is going to use, how much oxygen you'll sell. But if it's a diversified market, it's very difficult to predict. Say, we install a plant in Toronto. There are all types of industries here. So it's very hard to say, you know, what will be the liquid market for that. So there's some ways of doing that. One is to look at GDP growth, and there's this gas intensity market estimates. We have this radius model, so we look at the growth in this sub-region only and see how that can be done. But this is actually a big area for us to research on how to better estimate that. And the other one is energy, right? Because especially in the U.S., energy markets are unregulated. So you buy energy, it's almost like the stock market, right? So you have to need, there's a lot of risk in contracting energy. There are some hedging schemes, but in many cases it's very difficult to do it. And to close this part, I don't have much time, but I'll cover the other part here in practice. So we're working on implementing risk analysis. Well, risk management, there's still a lot of art in that. So we're trying to bring more science in quantifying risks, in modeling risk, in assessing risk, and educating the business decision makers on how to look at those risks and make decisions based on that. Sometimes quantifying risk factors are tough or even impossible. So we have to incorporate sometimes qualitative factors. We have to look at long time frameworks, and we need consistent historical data. So I know that history doesn't tell you what the future will be, but at least it's better than nothing, right? So you need some good historical data. Sometimes we don't have this in practice, so it's very hard to get data. As I mentioned here, educating decision makers is very difficult. A lot of people don't believe in probability distribution or in statistics, so a lot of skepticism there. The other thing, as I mentioned to you, I hope I gave you the message, there are several risk factors, and they're emerging from different areas. So when I talk about technology risks, you have to talk to R&D and to see, you know, what are the technologies that are coming up, and what are the risks involved in that. When you talk about country risk, you have to talk to financial people. Sometimes you have to hire consultants. You have to go to Wall Street and look for their advice on that. We have market risk. You have to talk to business development, salespeople. So you have inputs from everywhere to try to quantify those risks. The models, and that's here critical, right? These people are not necessarily mathematically sound, so they want simple solutions. They want fast and defensible solutions in that. So their processes have to be very simple. So there's always the trade-off of overcomplicating things, making it difficult, or only an expert can do that. So we're trying to make these processes relatively simple as much as they can be. And they have to be easy to understand and interpret. So we're trying to express the same metrics they use on a point value basis as a probability distribution. The discretizing, as I showed you in the past, like in a few slides ago, the several probabilities and the IRRs. You know, there are ways of doing that and make it more understandable. And here is one person one of the decision makers mentions this to us, paralysis by analysis. So sometimes you overanalyze things, and they have to make capital decisions quickly. So they cannot wait for the model to run or for us to get better data or improve our process. So that's, you know, the other thing we face in there. Okay. So let me just switch to the, I have 15 minutes, but I'll get into that, and bring a little more of the mathematical programming flavor here. On a project in which we incorporated risk into optimization to part of our supply chain. Before I move in there, I don't know if you have any questions or any comments. If not, I'll continue. So I'll mention this work where we looked at demand risk. So we have the liquid demand risk, and we were trying to incorporate this demand risk into capacity allocation and distribution planning. Actually, this work was done with Carnegie Mellon. We're members of their, they have an industrial consortium, and we're working with them in optimization problems. So Ignacio Grossman is a professor there at Carnegie Mellon, and we've been working on that together. So I mentioned to you the supply chain. So here we have a plant. You have the on-site customer, but we're concerned with the liquid market. So we serve the neighborhood of that plant with several customers, right? And one of the things that we do here, say if a new customer comes and asks us for a product, we install the tank at the customer. So it's our capital invested there, and we sign a long-term contract. In this case, a 3 to 5, sometimes 7-year contract. So we build the plant here, and then we manage the inventory at the customer. So we make sure the product is always there. So we have telemetry systems that will online, we'll read the product level, and we'll determine when to go there and serve that customer. Okay. So demand here is a risk for new and existing customers. So why is demand a risk here? When we sign a contract with a customer, he will tell you, I need 1,000 of that product. But he doesn't know how much, in fact, he needs. Because this is a 5-year contract. His demand may grow a lot or may be much smaller than he thinks. So there's the risk here of installing a large tank think it's better. I'm installing a large tank, but sometimes, and this tank will be underutilized, so you're spending more capital than you need, right? So there is a risk in that, and even existing customers. So, you know, as the business of this customer grows, the demand will increase, or sometimes the demand decreases, and sometimes we have to adjust capital in there. So we have to adjust the tank size in there. So sometimes you can have upgrades or downgrades in the tanks. Okay? And typically we work with off-the-shelf tank sizes. So it's not that we're working with a, you know, continuous variable defining the tank size, but we have a set of discrete sizes for that. And we also supply customers with different trailer sizes. So when we go to customers, we have, you know, two, sometimes three, sometimes, you know, five different trailer sizes. Okay? So this is the problem that we're trying to solve here. So we're installing capital capacity at the plant, and you have uncertainty in demand, not only for new customers, but also for existing customers. Right? So the trade-off here that we look at is the distribution versus capital cost. Right? So if you want to install a large tank at a customer, you are making your distribution easier because you have more capacity installed. You have more room for supplying that customer. However, you are spending more money in there. And here we're talking about hundreds of customers, so it's a lot of money invested in tanks. Right? So what we look at here is the effects of customer synergies and tank availability. Because when we distribute to customers, you go not only to one customer, but you actually go through a route. So what we call a milk run. So you serve customer A, B, C in the same route. Right? It's like UPS, like a, you know, the mail system will go to several customers. Right? So, you know, this is what we're trying to capture here. And once you formulate this problem, it's far from being trivial, because it's actually a highly combinatorial problem, because you have hundreds of customers and they have to be grouped together, right? And there, it's not obvious how to group them together, how to define clusters or neighborhoods in those, on those customers. Right? So you have many thousands of combinations of customer combinations possible, and you have lots of possible routes for each decision. So all this makes this problem very difficult. And I know I don't have much time to go in details here, but that, let me just tell you how we first looked at this problem. So here is the deterministic problem. So assuming there's no demand uncertainty, the way we looked at the problem was we first cluster the customers. So we have, say, hundreds of customers. We separate them into clusters, so neighborhoods, right? And then we try to solve, or we solved actually, the integrated model. So this is a large mixed integer linear programming model in which we have tank sizing decisions and routing decisions, and they are solved simultaneously. So as you can expect, here is a large-scale MILP that takes a large amount of CPU time with the benefit of being a very accurate and providing a global optimum solution. And why is that a global optimum? Because actually we generate here, in a clustering algorithm, we generate a first solution. We solve this integrated model and say we obtain a solution for this clustering, clustering division here. Then we solve this several times, and we obtain different solutions, and we set a termination criteria here, and we pick, say, the best solution found so far. So there's, after a certain number of iterations, you see that, you know, in this case, you know, the third iteration you can get the optimal solution in there. Okay? So that's how we looked at the problem. So the challenges here is, well, when I have demand uncertainty, right, the problem that I mentioned here, the integrated routing and tank sizing, becomes a lot more complicated because now demand is uncertain. Right? So how do we tackle this problem? And here I'll mention this three quickly because we don't have much time. So the first thing we do is to find what we call a continuous approximation approach for routing. So instead of solving routing as a set of combinations of integer variables A, B, C, D as customers. We approximate this by continuous variables, and there is a good amount of literature that looks into that. The other thing we do is on-demand uncertainty, we define safety stocks. Right? So safety stocks will account for demand uncertainty. And this is the third one is actually the most interesting part, and that's actually the feedback we got from the business when we showed them the solution that we had so far at this point. They said, okay, our main point of doing this project was to tell them that sometimes or most of the time we overestimate the tank sizes of the customer. And why is that? Because they don't look at neighbors. They don't look at, you know, neighbor customers. And they just look at one customer at a time. So they don't capture synergies among customers, right? So the point, the counter argument they would always give us is that what if we add or if we lose customer, more importantly? So you're installing a tank next to at a customer, counting on its neighbors to deliver. But what if this customer disappears? So we no longer have that customer. So we look at the probability of adding losing customers in this framework. And what you end up is a multi-scenario approach. And here I'm going to skip a few slides because we don't have much time and just give you the final algorithm for that and just one example. Right? So here, for instance, if I have a three-year planning horizon, right, and I have four customers, six tank sizes, six types of trucks. So here I have, what is the new customer here? Well, here I don't have new customers, but here I have a probability of adding, of losing customers. So for instance, if at the end of year one, I can lose this N15, this customer, I start building my scenario tree by saying, you know, scenario one, is this customer still there? This customer is no longer there. In the second year, I may lose customer 18. So in this case, I may have customer 18 and not having 15 and so forth. So you can build this scenario tree over the time span that you're looking at. And you look at the probabilities in there. So the way we do this is we calculate a safety stock and tank sizes at the higher level, and then we do a detailed routing model for every scenario here. And in every scenario, we obtain the optimal solution. And by doing that, we actually look at the total expected cost once we do over every scenario. Right? And the other interesting thing here is, actually, the model, when we do the continuous approximation, I didn't have time to go through that, is actually a non-convex MINLP. Right? And the way we do that is, in a way, what Nick described on a branch and reduce technique, in which actually the safety stock generates a square root term. And the square root term is actually done by a branch and refine scheme, you know, exactly the way or very similar to the way that Nick described it here. So we build a convex envelope, we find lower and upper bounds, find relaxations, etc., and we get to that solution. So here we have cases in which we find the optimal tank sizes, the service level, and obtain the optimal solution for that. So this is actually a model that we're using for sizing tanks at customers and actually analyzing our supply chain in how well or how much we overinvested in capital and redefine our decisions based on that. Okay, so with that, I'll thank you and I'll be happy to take any questions.